Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, since we have some warm fall weather, I thought that we'd revisit one of my favorite essays written many years ago by Mr. John T. McCutcheon. In fact, it appeared in the Chicago Tribune on September 30th, 1907. Great story entitled Injun Summer. And John writes in the vernacular of the time, "Yep, sonny, this is sure enough Injun Summer. Don't know what that is, I reckon, do you? Well, that's when all the homesick Injuns come back to play. You know, a long time ago, long afore your granddaddy was born even, there was heaps and heaps of Injuns around here, thousands, millions, I reckon, far as that's concerned. Regular, sure enough, Injuns, none of your cigar store Injuns, not much. They was all around here, right here where you're standing. Don't be scared. Ain't none around here now, leastways no live ones. They've been gone this many a year. They all went away and died, so they ain't no more left. But every year, long about now, they all come back, leastways their spirits do. They're here now. You can see them off across the fields. Look real hard. See that kind of hazy, misty look out yonder? Well, them's Injuns. Injun spirits marching along and dancing in the sunlight. That's what makes that kind of haze that's everywhere. It's just the spirits of the Injuns all come back. They're all around us now. See off yonder? See them teepees? They kind of look like corn shocks from here, but them's Injun tents, sure as you're a foot high. See them now? Sure. I knowed you could. Smell that smoky sort of smell in the air? That's the campfires are burning and their pipes going. Lots of people say it's just leaves burning. Nah. But it ain't. It's the campfires, and the Injuns are hopping around them to beat the old Harry. You just come out here tonight when the moon is hanging over the hill off yonder, and the harvest fields is all swimming in the moonlight, and you can see the Injuns and the teepees just as plain as can be. You can, huh? I know you could, and I know you will after a while. Did you ever notice how the leaves turn red about this time of year? Well, that's just another sign of redskins. That's when an old Injun spirit gets tired dancing and goes up and squats on a leaf to rest. Well, I can hear him rustling and whispering and creeping around among the leaves all the time. And ever once in a while, a leaf gives way under some fat old Injun ghost and comes floating down to the ground. See? Here's one now. See how red it is? That's the war paint rubbing off an Injun ghost, sure as you're born. Pretty soon, all the Injuns will go marching away again, back to the happy hunting ground, but next year you'll see them trooping back, the sky just hazy with them, and their campfires smoldering away, just like they are now. Injun Summer, John T. McCutcheon, first appeared in the Chicago Tribune back in 1907, usually runs around this time of year, around Halloween, early November. Mr. McCutcheon was a graduate of Purdue University. In fact, he won the Pulitzer Prize for a cartoonist in 1932. He was considered the dean of American cartoonists. But his tenure at the Tribune was terminated because someone was critical of the American Indian. Of course, that's politically incorrect nowadays. But if you remember the cartoon that accompanied Injun Summer, it's the little boy with his grandpa smoking a pipe, Grandpa was smoking a pipe, of course. Looking out into the field with the corn shacks, just had the harvest, and the leaves that they had just raked were burning and smoldering away, and the moon was just setting down during the evening. Well, the grandpa, of course, analogizes that and tells that little boy, well, those aren't really corn shacks. Those are Injun teepees. And the hazy smoke coming off the burning leaves are really the Injuns dancing in the moonlight as the moon kind of comes up for the evening. But a classic, and certainly something I like to revisit every year because it's, I remember reading it to all my kids whenever it would come out. I don't know if it even showed up in the Chicago Tribune magazine. Not that the Chicago Tribune magazine is in existence anymore, but certainly something that we like to reread every year and remember what John T. McCutcheon started so many years ago on September 30th, 1907. Injun Summer. I thought we'd play a little Rascals continuing last week since they were in town. This is one of my favorites. How Can I Be Sure? We'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show.
How can I be sure in a world that's constantly changing? How can I be sure where I stand with you? Whenever confuse me, touch me, but don't take me down. Whenever I'm away from you, my alibi is telling people I don't care for you. Maybe I'm just hanging around with my head up, upside down. It's a pity I can't seem to find someone who's as pretty and lovely as you. How can I be sure? I really, really, really wanna know. I really,
Rascals, How Can I Be Sure? We're back on The Kevin Moore Show. Well, I thought the best way to introduce my next very special guest is maybe to start out with some words from his great-great-grandfather in one of the great pieces of literature from, of course, A Christmas Carol. I have endeavored in this ghostly little book to raise the ghost of an idea which shall not put my readers out of humor with themselves, with each other, with the season, or with me. May it haunt their houses pleasantly, and no one wish to lay it. Their faithful friend and servant, written in December of 1843, Charles Dickens. Marley was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. There is no doubt that Marley was dead. This must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of the story I'm going to relate. And something wonderful is happening in Chicago coming up on the 17th. This November, Chicago is in store for what the Boston Globe called a Dickens of a performance. Visiting all the way from England, Gerald Charles Dickens is the great-great-grandson of Charles Dickens, the literary genius who wrote all those unforgettable stories, David Copperfield, A Tale of Two Cities, The Adventures of Oliver Twist, The Great Expectations, and America's favorite, A Christmas Carol. On Sunday, November 17th, starting at 1, kick off the holiday season and experience this exclusive theatrical event featuring Gerald and his celebrated performances of Mr. Dickens is Coming and A Christmas Carol. Presented by British Taste Events, a new company dedicated to the promotion of all things British, An Afternoon with Mr. Dickens will feature all the fun, pathos, and drama of the master storyteller brought to life on the stage of the historic Stan Mansion located at 2408 North Kedzie. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning British actor and performer, former president of the Dickens Fellowship, public speaker, solo performing artist, a very talented and accomplished performer who proudly carries on the literary and inspirational legacy of his iconic and beloved great-great-grandfather, the immortal Charles Dickens, as he presents his hit one-man show, which is said to have become a once-in-a-lifetime brush with literary history. An Afternoon with Mr. Dickens on Sunday, November 17th at 1 at the historic Stan Mansion, 2408 North Kedzie, presented by Connie and Victor Allister of British Taste Events. We're honored to welcome Gerald Charles Dickens. Gerald, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Well, thank you very much, and what a welcome. I'm blushing.
Well, I never thought I would have Mr. Dickens on my show, and I do.
That is wonderful.
You know, I did my senior thesis in college on Charles Dickens and certainly enjoyed everything he wrote, and A Christmas Carol, of course, is one of my favorites. And you're carrying on the tradition and the legacy of your great-great-grandfather.
Well, absolutely, and that little clip you read from A Christmas Carol, the preface, the introduction, when mm-hmm. he said, you know, may it haunt their houses pleasantly and no one wish to lay it. It's doing pretty well, isn't it? 2013, no one's put it down yet.
Well, I'm doing some research, and I was just reading this. It's interesting, you started your performance of the shows about your great-great-grandfather 150 years after he wrote A Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm. Was that intentional?
Well, it wasn't actually my idea, I have to say. I was acting at that time. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I purposefully distanced myself from having anything to do with performing Dickens. Mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to have my own career and make a separation. But there was so much publicity about the 150th anniversary of A Christmas Carol in 1993. And a lady who was responsible for raising funds for a local charity came to me and said, look, this is too good an opportunity to miss. Why don't we recreate one of the readings that Dickens himself used to perform mm-hmm. of A Christmas Carol? He was well known for being a great theatrical performer. And when he got on stage and performed his own dramatic readings, they were amazing theater events. So I sort of a bit reluctantly agreed to do it and said, well, it's only going to be a one-off. I'll only ever do it once. You do understand that. And she said, oh, yes, that's fine. And to approach the project, I sort of decided, rather than trying to recreate and pretend to be Charles Dickens, I thought, well, I'm going to look at it from a modern perspective. I'll treat this as a script, and I am an actor working from the script. And I started developing it and finding out where all the wonderful emotions and atmospheres came in the book, and started giving all of the different characters separate voices and expressions and ways of standing and all these things. And I was so proud of myself. I thought, goodness, I've done a great job on this. I've reinvented the Christmas Carol for a new generation. I've changed it all. And then I went back and did a little bit of research about Dickens' own readings and discovered that he had done exactly the same thing 100 years before, and I'd reinvented precisely nothing.
So you weren't acting. That's in your DNA. That came natural to you.
Maybe that's it.
which is something we revisit every year. Of course, you're talking about the Christmas Carol now, but his favorite work was David Copperfield, was it not?
Well, he always said that. Well, he always said whichever book he'd just written.
Oh, okay, right.
Because that was a good marketing tool. But certainly David Copperfield was very, very personal to him. There's a lot of his own life in it. The character having to work in dismal conditions, the father figure in Copperfield, of course, it's Mr. Micawber, but the father figure being imprisoned for debt. Now, these were all things that happened to Charles in his childhood, mm-hmm. and he was so ashamed of this background that he never told anybody. He didn't tell his wife or his children. Nobody knew about this part of his childhood. So to be able to write David Copperfield was almost cathartic for him. It almost gave him a chance to tell this story that was weighing so heavily on him, but without it being recognizably his. And it's no coincidence that the initials of the lead character of David Copperfield is Charles's own initials reversed, CD and DC.
Oh, interesting.
So, it was a book that he cared very deeply about.
Well, here's a man who, as you said, came from upbringing, had to suffer some of this. The good times and the bad times, went through that, but he remembered everything. He had a memory that he remembered people and places and events and so forth, which translated him in the caricatures that he brought together in his work.
Yeah. He was trained really as a journalist and had a great eye for detail. Nothing mm-hmm. escaped him. And also a great sense of the human character. He could pick out character traits as easily as anything and see them. So when he did come to write, of course, his novels are just filled with these fantastic characters. They're so good. And often they appear to be almost caricatures, rather over right. the top. But they are instantly recognizable as real people as well, because we all know these people. We've all met them. And even in 2013, they still surround us. You know?
Right. And he brought to light the socioeconomic and labor conditions of the poor during the time, and people started to take note and said, wait a second, we have to do something about this.
Mm-hmm. Very much. And that was achieved by personal experience. He'd lived, when he was working in the factory at the age of 12, he'd lived in the worst parts of London. He'd seen crime. He'd seen poverty. Mm-hmm. And then later, when he became a journalist, he became a parliamentary reporter. So he was listening to all of the debates in the British government and was furious that there was this huge gulf between the rich, moneyed, titled politicians who are speaking a lot of hot air all the time and the poverty on the streets that he had seen firsthand. But where he was clever is he wrote in such an entertaining way. So he was never lecturing. He was never bashing people over the head mm-hmm. with these needs for reform. He was just bringing it to their notice in brilliant, entertaining literature, which people desperately wanted to follow. Of course, he published all his books in monthly installments, so he could string the readers along. So they had to come and buy the next one. They were so excited to find out what was going to happen in the plot. But all the time, he was bringing to the fore these terrible conditions and what needed to be done.
Which is an interesting point you bring up, Gerald, is the serialization of the Victorian novels at the time. Mm-hmm. And especially, as Dickens, he started out with Pickwick Papers and, of course, with A Christmas Carol. But he was able to get then the comments or the retort of the people who read the one before previously and would kind of dictate a little bit how he was going to move forward in some of his other work.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The serialization was a very, very clever way of writing, because firstly, you didn't have to write an 800-page book all at once before it hit the bookstall, so his work was always in print, that there was always something being published. Secondly, as you say, it meant he could react to public opinion, and he did, there was a lovely phrase he used to use. If things weren't quite working, he'd just throw another character on the fire, you know, and it would blaze up again into another great, bright, flaming plot. So, he could be very dictated. But the amazing thing was he was often working on two or three novels at the same time.
How can he keep all those characters separate?
Precisely. And the one might be a sort of comic novel, and the other might be very dark and full of pathos, and he was absolutely able to separate all of these and keep these characters separate. Extraordinary. What on earth would he have done with a notebook or an iPad or something? It doesn't bear thinking about.
Who were some of the authors that he read as a child? Even though they were not well off, he was a voracious reader. Who were some of the authors he read?
He loved adventure stories. Mm-hmm. He loved things like The Arabian Nights, okay. Robinson Crusoe, and a character called Roderick Random, who sort of all boys' hero, always getting into adventures. But they all had the similarity that they were serialized almost adventure books, so he could follow them through. He loved that sort of thing. Loved plot, loved adventure, loved big characters.
Are there some copies of his original manuscripts that still exist?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, plenty. Actually, after he died, everything, all his belongings, were auctioned off in a huge auction at Gad's Hill Place, his house. So everybody was buying collections of the manuscripts and the papers and the various things. So a lot of them exist in museums across the world. I mean, there's plenty in America. I believe there's a collection in Chicago. It certainly is in Philadelphia and New York. And I've been able to see some of those, study some of those. The original handwritten manuscript of A Christmas Carol is in the Pierpont Morgan Library in New York City, and I've seen that on a number of occasions. It's amazing.
I thought you might have some stuck in your library at home or something.
I wish. But I always think, actually, these manuscripts are in the perfect place now. they're well-preserved, they're well-looked after, and they're available to Dickens's public, Dickens's readership.
Sure,
and they are
sure.
The important ones. You know, if I had one, I'd probably write a telephone number on it or put a coffee cup on it or something terrible, and it would be awful.
Now, you said initially, of course, we know that Mr. Dickens came and did book tours. He did readings and so forth. He did that throughout Europe, but he came to the United States and did that. Never made it to Chicago, but his brother made it to Chicago.
His brother moved out to Chicago a few years before. You know, left England and came and settled in Chicago, and died in the city and is buried in the city. So, yeah, so Augustus Dickens, who actually played a very important role in Dickens's literary career, although unwittingly and unknowingly, in that when little Augustus was a child, he was given the nickname of Moses, which was after a character in Oliver Goldsmith's novel, The Vicar of Wakefield. And all the other children played with him and called him Moses. And, of course, he tried to repeat the name, but being very little, he couldn't quite pronounce it properly, and he had sinus problems, so still he couldn't pronounce it properly. So instead of Moses, the name came out as Boz, which was the pen name that Dickens used when he began to write. He stole Augustus's nickname and then started writing.
Sketches by Boz, that's right.
Sketches by Boz, right. And he was still writing as Boz right the way through Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby and, I believe, into the Old Curiosity Shop as well.
Now, did you get all this information passed down from generation to generation? Your father told you, your grandfather told him, and his great-great-grandfather, then so forth?
I got an awful lot of my information from my father, who is a great Dickens expert. He loved to study Dickens, both his life and his work.
Uh-huh.
But the thing about Charles Dickens was he was an absolute rock star of his time. So everything was recorded. Everything was written about him. So there's no shortage of research material at your fingertips. It's everywhere. So I'm very, very fortunate from that point of view. It's very, very easy. But the lovely thing about traveling to cities, and unfortunately not Chicago, but places where he visited, which you can get the other side of the story. People will dig out old newspapers, and this is how the press reported Dickens's visit here, and this is where he stayed, and that's where the railroad station used to be, where he came in. So traveling around America, I can sort of build up the picture from the other side as well, which is always really, really rewarding.
He was a very personable man.
He could be.
He could be, okay. And sometimes not.
No, he was. You can see that through his novels. You can just tell. He had his moments. He could be very, very difficult. I think he was a very difficult family man to live with.
Mm-hmm.
He was very driven. Mainly, I think, because of his experiences in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
He was desperate that poverty would never visit his house again.
Mm-hmm.
So was driven to work as hard as possible. He always wanted to make more money, not because he wanted money, but because failure to make money was a personal failure.
Right.
He wasn't interested in the material things. That wasn't the point. But and that drive, that energy, could be very difficult to live with, and he could be very short-tempered. But he could also be a generous, a brilliant host. He threw the most wonderfully lavish parties, which he didn't necessarily control. He just sort of set them in motion and sat back and let everybody else have the most wonderful time. So, a very generous and a brilliant man.
Well, he had a boatload of kids, too, didn't he?
There were 10 of them. It's not bad going.
Which is very interesting, and we still carry the legacy today, which is so much fun. And are you having fun doing this?
I absolutely absolutely love it. I've been doing it for 20 years now.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And...
Why haven't you been to Chicago? That's my question. It's the first time you've been to Chicago.
I am absolutely delighted. Absolutely delighted that at last I'm coming to Chicago. And what better organization to come with? It's all falling into place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. We'll make the British connection in Chicago. I'm so excited to be coming to the city, and I hope it'll be the first of many, many visits.
Now, we had a couple of great people that put this together, Rebecca Cussman from Chicago, and of course Victor and Connie Alistair from British Taste Events, and Lisa Porter, of course, who's working with you there. But we got to get you back to Chicago more often, because coming around the holidays would be just a delight to have a show that you do about the Christmas Carol and all of your great great grandfather's works.
Well, it's so wonderful that we've managed to get this date in the diary for this year, and hopefully it'll be. There'll be the first of many, and we can lead on to many other visits. I'd love to. Yeah.
What are some of your favorite works from your great great grandfather?
Oh, do you know, it's one of the big bits of advice my father gave me.
No, never choose one. Right?
How to answer this question, and I've never got it right, because I usually end up just listing all 15 novels. I think probably out of all of them, my favorite is Great Expectations.
Really? Okay.
It's a wonderful novel. Mm-hmm. It's got fantastic characters. It's a great plot. It's one of his last novels. It's the second to last of the completed novels. So he was at the top of his craft when he wrote that. But then you go right to the beginning of his career, and the wonderful Pickwick Papers.
Oh, sure.
Just silly and funny, and here we go. I'm now going to start listing all of them from the beginning. I'm going to stop there.
Well, in the holidays, it's a Christmas Carol for all of us. We all know that. We all know it's a Christmas Carol around the holidays.
And to perform a Christmas Carol is just an absolute joy. You can't ask for any more as a performer than to say those words.
Well, lucky for us, and certainly lucky for us to be able to enjoy your performance coming up on the 17th. Mr. Dickens Is Coming is a lighthearted and varied look at the life and character of Charles Dickens, and with its fresh and modern perspective, is a huge internationally acclaimed hit. Gerald's performance of A Christmas Carol has received standing ovations all over the world. Using his own adaptation of Charles Dickens's classic Christmas tale, he plays over 30 characters, using his vocal and physical talents to bring each scene vividly to life. Known for his one-man shows based on the novels of his great-great-grandfather, Gerald Dickens will give guests a rare, up close and personal performance described by the New York Times as a once-in-a-lifetime brush with literary history. Sunday, November 17th, starting at 1 at the historic Stan Mansion, 2408 North Kedzie. On the line with us right now is Gerald Charles Dickens. Gerald, I can't tell you how delightful it's been to chat with you, and an honor to have you on.
It's been a real, real pleasure. And thank you so much. It's been great to chat.
I want to wish you safe travels, and I'm going to make sure, do what I can to see if you can come back into Chicago and visit us.
Fantastic. I'll look forward to that. And I'm so looking forward to Sunday. It'll be a great day. I'm really looking forward to it.
And certainly have a good holiday season.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Gerald.
It's been a pleasure.
Gerald Charles Dickens, the great-great-grandson of the immortal Charles Dickens, presenting his one-man show, which is said to have become a once-in-a-lifetime brush with literary history. An afternoon with Mr. Dickens on Sunday, November 17th at 1 at the historic Stan Mansion, 2408 North Kedzie, presented by Connie and Victor Alistair of British Taste Events. Should be a wonderful time. And certainly we thank Lisa Porter for putting things together. We thank Rebecca Cussman for putting us in touch with everyone to make this happen. Never thought I'd have Mr. Dickens on the show, but there you go. Metropolis Performing Arts Center welcomes Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Sean Mullins on November 23rd at 8 o'clock. Sean Mullins is more than just a Grammy-winning singer-songwriter who cemented his place in history with hits like Lullaby and Light You Up. He's also an amazing storyteller. In between playing his unforgettable folk rock tunes, Mullins tells tales of being on the road, what inspires him, and where he was when he wrote certain songs. And in Metropolis's intimate setting, you'll feel like Sean Mullins came into your living room to share all of this with you. Again, Sean Mullins will be at the Metropolis on November 23rd at 8 o'clock. And on the line with us right now is the Grammy Award-winning vocalist who's had chart-topping success with his hits such as Lullaby and Light You Up, nationally recognized singer whose hit single Shimmer was adopted as the unofficial anthem of Australia for the 2000 Summer Olympics, songwriter, teacher, multidimensional performer whose work spans the musical genres of folk rock, instrumental rock, adult Alternative and Americana, now appearing at the Metropolis Performing Arts Center Saturday evening, November 23rd at 8, 111 West Campbell in downtown Arlington Heights. Mr. Sean Mullins. Sean, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Good to have you, and great to chat with you a little bit. You've been to Metropolis before, haven't you?
Yes, a bunch of times. I love playing Metropolis. It's one of my favorite venues that way.
Well, it's so conducive, Sean, to your music because, you know, you have such a connection with your audience, and it is like you're in a small space, and you're just kind of doing more than singing. You're kind of just chatting and sharing your talents with the listeners.
Yeah, well, I guess I look to, you know, I really look to people like John Prine and Steve Goodman. There's a bunch of guys out of that Chicago scene that, and I kind of look to those as kind of those, that 70s songwriter, storyteller thing. I guess I'm just trying to keep alive. There's a bunch of us doing it, you know. I'm still, of course, but I love doing it. I mean, I love the road when I do it. I enjoy it, and but I really look to those guys kind of as the heroes, you know, Christofferson, and the list goes on and on, you know.
But well, I listened to you, and I enjoyed your work, and you remind me a lot of a younger James Taylor.
Oh, that's nice.
You really do. I mean, just the way you present yourself and the stories that you tell. And some stories are quite interesting. Of course, Lullaby is a great song. I don't know if you should call it Rockabye or Lullaby, but it's a...
Well, it's, I probably should have called it.
And, of course, now when you have the video attached to the song, does that, when you're watching that, does that give you a different feel as to thinking about how and when and why you wrote it?
Well, you know, the videos almost always, especially for a new artist, like at the time I was considered a new artist, so I didn't have much control over video, you know, productions and the direction of them. And so I also didn't know much about it, so I just trusted the video directors, and they have their own interpretation of stories. So that when I see that video from time to time, they'll still play that. And what I remember is shooting the video.
Okay, okay.
You know, I remember that whole day. We was just a quick one-day shoot, and it was the first thing I'd ever done like that, and it was a blast.
I bet you it was. You had to do takes and retakes, and it took you a whole day to do a three-minute song.
Exactly, yeah. It's the locations that'll get you. You know, they got to go, you know, especially when you're in the L.A. area, they'll take you from a bar over in downtown old Los Angeles, and then your next shoot's going to be near the beach, and then your next shoot somewhere else. And so that's how you end up spending so much time, you know. I knew my song pretty well.
Now, you're originally from Atlanta, and but you have traveled to and had a lot of success in Los Angeles and the Hollywood area.
Yeah, I never lived there, but I did the kind of thing that a lot of, you know, on the road guys do, where they spend a lot of time, you know, you sleep on friends' couches and you camp, and you do whatever you got to do along the way. And I guess for the first 9 or 10 years, that's how it was for me before that first single, Lullaby, really hit. And so, yeah, it was a drastic change to kind of go from that kind of lifestyle to getting to stay in nicer hotels and cozy beds and everything. But I still love camping and hiking, you know. My girlfriend and I do that constantly, and so I guess I'm kind of between the road. When I'm not on the road, I really like to be in the woods.
Well, you're an outdoors guy, and it shows in some of the work and the songs that you've written and have sung. Your background, of course, in college, you were in the marching band. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's a military college is actually what that University of North Georgia is.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army helped me pay for college, so I signed a little ROTC scholarship thing.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing, the captain comes out of the big building and he goes, who here can play a musical instrument? And of course, you know, I raised my hand. What can you play? And I said, well, I play a little guitar and piano and drums. He goes, you can play a little drums? And I said, yes, sir. And he goes, perfect, you're in the band. So that's how I became a snare drummer in the marching band, and I really didn't know much about it.
But it was fun nonetheless.
Yeah, it was.
And then your travels took you to co-writing songs. Tell us a little bit about that. I think that's a unique way of approaching music.
Yeah, well, the first time I really did that was with the Thorns, with Matthew Sweet and Pete Droege. And Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket was part of that early writing.
Oh, okay.
Writing I should say quartet, as well as a fine producer-songwriter by the name of Marshall Altman, who lives in Nashville and is doing really well producing country acts. But he wrote a lot of some of that stuff. So that was my first time really doing that, where you're sitting around with several people trying to come up with a song. And I think we all learned a lot from that. I don't think any of us had done it a lot before, you know.
Well, it's brainstorming more than anything else. It's like putting a bunch of business people together and figuring out how do we make something successful.
Yeah, it really is. And how to make it rhyme. And do you, you know, everyone has their own feeling about kind of how a song should be phrased. And do you do perfect or hard rhymes, or do you not worry about it? And so that's all that kind of stuff that gets worked out. And just like a business meeting, like you say, like a brainstorm, you kind of have to leave your ego at the door if you can, and make it as good for the song as you can.
I wonder if that's not how the Beatles made some of their hits.
Probably, although I wonder a lot of times, at least by the time they were writing more, I don't know. I'm no Beatles expert, but
yeah.
I listen to them constantly. And so I loved listening to them, and I feel like the lyrics and the melodies were very different between Paul and John especially. And I can kind of feel like I can pick out who wrote what, but, you know, everyone says that, right?
Well, sure.
But for me, it's, you know, it's getting better all the time. Better, better, better. That sounds like McCartney, and then to me it sounds like it can't get no worse.
That's and Lennon, okay.
Yeah. And so I think when they co-wrote, it was that kind of probably, if it was like any other songwriting thing, you know, I can almost hear John Lennon go, it can't get no worse, mate. You know? Oh, that's perfect. You know.
little yin and yang going, probably.
Yeah, which is beautiful and perfect and the best ever, you know.
You know, you had mentioned John Prine, you had mentioned Stevie Goodman, of course, I had mentioned James Taylor. What kind of music did you enjoy when you were growing up? Was it country music, or was it some of the contemporary music, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, groups like that?
All the stuff that we've already mentioned, you know, especially Prine. Christopherson was really big in my house. My dad loved Kris Kristofferson records. Mm-hmm. Janis Joplin, Isaac Hayes.
Sure.
The Jesus Christ Superstar soundtrack, the movie soundtrack, because I saw that when it first came out as just a little kid, and the Billy Jack soundtrack.
Sure, I mean, Tom Laughlin, wasn't that his name? Tom Laughlin,
Tom
Billy
Laughlin.
Jack, yeah, right.
And I loved Billy Jack. I wanted to be just like
him. Right, exactly.
but a lot of that kind of late 60s, early 70s thing hit me, you know, that songwriter, John Denver. You know, my dad loved Joan Baez, and it was always funny because they were kind of weekend hippies back then, and my mom came from a real conservative Southern Democrat family, and but she was like, well, I like Joan Baez's voice, but I just don't know about her politics, you know, it was always funny.
Now, who do you listen to now? Who do you enjoy now?
Well, I'm a big McMurtry fan. I mean, since I heard about him in the early 90s, James McMurtry's become one of my favorite songwriters. Whatever he puts out, I always buy. You know, I love Ray LaMontagne. I think he's wonderful and really original and different for right now. He's got a really cool, different voice. The brand new stuff, I mean, there's a lot going on. I mean, it seems like every week there's something new. I love anything acoustic. But I really enjoy stuff that has kind of a lyrical thing to it. And sometimes, like, I enjoy listening to, you know, I have songwriter friends that are a little bit more judgmental than me. But I can be judgmental, too, when I hear a song and I don't know what the guy's talking about. I can start to go, well, he just didn't work hard enough on his song. And that might be true, but it also might be that's his thing. Like, you know, Ryan Adams writes like that a lot, and I love his music.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I find myself kind of with this inner turmoil while I'm listening to him, where I'm enjoying the sound of it so much, but I'm going, what the heck is he talking about?
You know. What's coming up next for Sean Mullins? Do you have any records or CDs in the works?
Yeah, I'm writing for one and doing little demos, just doing a lot of writing. I spent the summer and most of the fall, we did a little bit of touring, but spent a lot of time off, which was really nice, and hiking around and writing and spending time with my little boy who's four. And
oh gosh, that's great.
Yeah, it's been good. So I'm just kind of getting it cranking back up with this tour, and I'll be writing some while I'm out there too, I hope. And yes, just looking so forward to get back in the area.
Well, Christmas is always fun with a four-year-old, and I'm sure you'll have a ball with him then.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's all fantasy, man. It's great.
Sean Mullins is an American singer-songwriter who specializes in folk rock, instrumental rock, adult alternative, and Americana music. He is best known for the 1998 single Lullaby, which hit number one on the Adult Top 40 and was nominated for a Grammy Award. Metropolis' Performing Arts Center welcomes Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Sean Mullins on November 23rd at 8 o'clock. And on the line with us right now is Sean Mullins. Sean, I appreciate you taking a little time and chatting. I know you're going to be in a couple spots here in Chicago when you come out, right?
Yeah, I know about the Metropolis write off because we were talking about it, but
right.
I don't have any other dates in front of me. I'm sorry.
No, I should have some myself, but I know you're going to be. Well, we'll find out. I'll make sure that we let our listeners know.
Am I doing the City Winery in Chicago?
There you go. I think it is.
Yeah, and I've done the New York City Winery, which is a fantastic venue. So I expect it'll be wonderful.
Yeah, this is brand new. This is only a year or two old, and it's a great place, great venue, and much like Metropolis in that it's that intimate setting where almost the audience feels participatory in part of your singing. You know, that's kind of fun, too.
I love it when people sing along. That's and I should mention another influence that around the time I was in high school, I met Amy Ray and Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and they were just getting started themselves. And they were always a really good role models, both of them, for me, is kind of how to do it, you know, to do it with integrity and to do it for good causes and to always do as many benefits as you can. And so they were really influential, not only musically, but also kind of how to be a person, you know, and a musician, too.
That's interesting you say that, Sean, because I was educated by the Jesuits, and service to others is what we were taught. And what you're saying is very true. People come to Sean Mullins and say, can you help us out here? Unhesitatingly, you always respond. And I think that's very important for people to know that.
Yeah, well, we try. I mean, I can't do them all, but I do try. I'm going to try to do one here in late December, a friend of a friend with brain cancer kind of thing, and we're going to just, hey, let's do a show and try to raise some money and help where we can.
Well, if you need us to get the word out, Rebecca's got my number and so forth. I'm happy to mention it on the air, and if there's any way we can help out, too, we're there for you.
Hey, thank you so much.
Well, listen, safe travels to Chicago, and come back and visit us more often, will you, please?
I'd love that. Thanks for having me on.
And have a nice holiday.
All right, buddy, you too.
Thanks, Sean. Sean Mullins, one of the great singer-songwriters in America today, and he's going to be at a couple spots in Chicago. I'm glad he mentioned the City Winery, but Metropolis Performing Arts Center, Saturday evening, November 23rd, 8 o'clock, 111 West Campbell in downtown Arlington Heights. For tickets, 847-577-2121. What a talented guy, but delightful chatting with him, and I hope we can have him on again. McDonald's Thanksgiving Parade, a free event attracting hundreds of thousands of spectators, this year celebrates 80 years of Chicago holiday tradition. A dozen lovable character balloons, top marching bands from across the country, festive floats, cultural groups, equestrian groups, theatrical performances, and celebrity guests, plus over 1,000 dedicated volunteers all marching through the loop, make the McDonald's Thanksgiving Parade an annual celebration for the whole family. For those not in Chicago, the parade is broadcast in its entirety live for 3 hours on WGN 9 Chicago and WGN America. The 2013 McDonald's Thanksgiving Parade takes place live on State Street between Congress Parkway and Randall Street in downtown Chicago on Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 28th, from 8 to 11. This year, the parade's Grand Marshal is Drew Sidora. Star of VH1's biopic about TLC, Crazy, Sexy, Cool, is Tian Tebow's Watkins. Crazy, Sexy, Cool aired on October 21st and was the highest-rated telecast for the network in the last 5 years, averaging 4.5 million total viewers. Sidora is also known for her recurring role in the sitcoms The Game and That's So Raven, and for her role in Fox's Nurses. Some of her film credits include Never Die Alone, White Chicks, and Wild Hogs. She received rave reviews for playing dancer Lucy Avila in the hit Disney feature Step Up. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning businessman, entrepreneur, civic leader, impresario, nationally recognized organizer of community events, festivals, and parades, and a person sincerely dedicated in bringing holiday joy to the citizens of Chicagoland and their families, and the executive director of the Chicago Festival Association, now presenting the 80th annual McDonald's Thanksgiving Day Parade, Thursday, November 28th, from 8 to 11. Our good pal, Mr. Phil Purovich. Phil, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Kevin, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. It's become a tradition. You're in the warmer climes down in Florida talking to us now, but you'll be up here pretty soon, and we'll be celebrating Thanksgiving.
That's right. I'm looking forward to it. We're going to have a great show for everyone this year, and I just peeked in on the long-range weather forecast, and things are looking like they're going to be normal, which means seasonal, a little bit cooler than maybe people like it, but right now things are looking good.
Well, it's always fun to come down to the parade. We've weathered the storms. We've weathered the heat and the cold and the rain, but it's always fun, and everybody has a ball.
That's right. That's the important thing, and you hit it right in the head. Whether it's a warm, sunny day or cool with maybe some flurries in the air, people are out there to celebrate, to spend time with their families, and to be downtown Chicago on Thanksgiving morning.
And what's exciting, some of the great visitors you have that are going to be into the parade, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, it's always a great turnout.
They are, you know. We have an amazing relationship with them, and for them to come on and put on a show, you know, for the people of the city of Chicago to open the parade every year is really just remarkable. No other parade in the country could say they have that, and So it's really just an honor to continue to work with that group.
And what you do, Phil, and you do so well, is you have some live theater and some presentations and performances that people travel from around the country just to see. We're going to have, of course, Million Dollar Quartet. Well, I'll let you tell some of the groups, the special groups that are going to be there.
Yeah, Million Dollar Quartet, obviously that show started right here in Chicago, and, you know, it's won Tony Awards, and has been to Broadway, New York, and, you know, still running here, and we're thrilled to have them back with us again this year. The Black Ensemble Theater is going to be with us for the third year in a row, and they're an incredibly talented theatrical troupe again right here in Chicago. And the Light Opera Works from Evanston was with us several years ago and are back with us again this year. And they're going to do a wonderful routine as well. And you know, we're just really lucky to have this parade in Chicago where we have access to great theater, both, you know, the Broadway productions, and we are going to do the Broadway production Elf will be in the parade this year, but the, you know, so-called off-loop theater, the smaller theater troupes, and even the community theater groups that participate are all just tremendous and have a lot of variety to the parade.
Well, it's kind of a kickoff for the Christmas season, of course, although we all celebrate Thanksgiving, but Emerald City is going to have Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. You had mentioned Elf is going to be there. Theater at the Center, our good pal Bill Pulinski will be there with the Christmas Carol. And of course, as you mentioned, Light Opera Works with Annie Get Your Gun. It's a great time for not only the kids, but for the adults to see some of this theater.
And that's very important to us. You know, obviously people think of parades and they think of children. But, you know, we really provide entertainment for people of all ages. And, you know, our feedback is that, you know, younger kids, teens, and adults are all really find something in the parade that is entertaining for them, and you know, that's important to us because we do want the whole family to enjoy it, and you know, that's what keeps those streets packed on Thanksgiving morning.
And what's a parade without marching bands, right?
That's right.
We got Marist, and we have Rich South, and we have Kelly High School, and we have people coming from all over the country, which is amazing, Phil.
We do, and, you know, I don't have the list in front of me, but I counted the other day, and I think that we have 12 different states represented this year by marching bands. So, and we certainly have Chicago represented, but just to know that those groups from, you know, Iowa and Florida and Wisconsin and wherever else they're coming in from, Texas this year, you know, they have to fund these trips themselves, you know, sell candy, oranges, bake sales, car washes, whatever kids are doing these days. And they, you know, they pay their own freight in, and they do it because Chicago is a great city for them to visit, and this is a great parade for them to perform in.
You got the Budweiser Clydesdales, and the floats are always special. You know, you watch the Rose Bowl Parade, and every year it's just amazing some of the floats that come by, and you're going to have a lot of those in the parade this year.
We are. I think we're going to have a few more than normal. I think we're at 13 or 14 on our floats, and we have some great cultural groups that are going to be on floats this year. So not only will we see performances from the cultural groups, but, you know, the floats will be themed to represent their heritage as well. And so it's always a fun part of the parade.
You know, the kids always enjoy, and hopefully the weather will be with us a little bit, at least not too windy, the balloons that you have, and more balloons this year than I noticed in years past.
Yeah, always a crowd favorite, always going to be a crowd favorite. You know, those giant helium balloons are kind of synonymous with Thanksgiving parades now, and we've got some great new characters going to be debuting this year.
Curious George, the Tasmanian Devil, Tweety, Madeline, Sid the Science Kid, Arthur, and how do you factor in the fact that there is a problem with the wind? What happens when that comes in?
You know, just last weekend at the Museum of Science and Industry, we had parade school. And during parade school, we invite all the volunteers, all the balloon handlers, and all the rest of the officers to parade as well, out, and we have an orientation and training session. And so last Saturday, we had Tweety out on the lawn in front of the museum, and we had balloon handlers getting some training. And
okay.
So, and luckily, we had some nice breezes last Saturday, so they know what the wind feels like when it hits the balloon. They know what they need to do, and you know, we also have a balloon captain with each balloon, and that's someone that's a seasoned balloon veteran. And so they're providing instruction to the regular balloon handlers on the route to make sure that everybody stays safe.
It's interesting, you know, you have to go to balloon school in order to work for the parade.
That's right, balloon school. Yeah, it's certainly one of our most popular volunteer positions. It fills up quickly. We always have more people apply for those positions than we have spots available for them, which is unfortunate. But, you know, like I said, they're a crowd favorite, and it's a lot of fun bringing that balloon up State Street Thanksgiving morning.
Is this a year-round endeavor, Phil, that you have to put together the parade? Are you working on this the day after this one ends?
We do. And, you know, it's always a common question that people ask me when they find out what I do. But, you know, there are some parades that exist that don't need the amount of attention that we give this one. But it's important that we make the parade better every year. And to make it better, we have to find new units that are willing to perform in the parade. And that's a year-round task. And we also have to find sponsors that want to pay for the parade.
Mm-hmm.
And that is certainly a full-time job, you know, finding organizations that want to support an event like this. And so those two things specifically keep us busy year-round. And even our volunteer program, we have a leadership board of, you know, 20 or 25 people that meet year-round and help, you know, develop the parade, develop the program, and develop our sponsorship as well. So, you know, it's a really unique job. And, you know, there's three of us that work in the office full-time on it. And, you know, I can't speak to those two so much, but I love my job. It's the last job I ever have.
Well, I'm sure you're appreciative of McDonald's and CNH Industrial and One Main Financial and all the people that help sponsor the parade, because that's who makes it happen for all the moms and dads and the families and the grandmas and grandpas that come out to enjoy this the 80th anniversary of this parade.
That's right. Now, McDonald's has been a supporter of this parade for well over 20 years. They've been the title sponsor for probably half of those years. And, you know, they're a great partner to work with. And Case New Holland Industrials, you know, world headquarters out in Burr Ridge, you know, they're a great supporter of the event as well. And, you know, they see it as a chance to be part of the community. You know, they're not trying to sell, you know, their tractors and bulldozers and earth moving equipment to, you know, a regular family sitting in the stands. They're really participating because they see the value of this event in Chicago, and they want to be a good corporate citizen and support something that's good for the city of Chicago. And they're a wonderful partner. They're their 7th year with us this year.
Originally called the Christmas Caravan in the 1930s, the parade was created in 1934 to help lift the spirits of residents suffering through the Great Depression. Since then, it has developed into a full-scale spectacle that celebrates the holiday season. What once started out as an attempt to boost Chicago's economy has evolved into a cherished holiday tradition for Chicagoans and Americans alike. The parade includes performers and special guests representing every part of the country, as well as representing many cultures from around the world. Over 20 different cultures were represented in the 2012 parade. McDonald's Thanksgiving Parade, a free event attracting hundreds of thousands of spectators, this year celebrates 80 years of Chicago holiday tradition. a dozen lovable character balloons, top marching bands from across the country, festive floats, cultural groups, equestrian groups, theatrical performances, and celebrity guests, plus over 1,000 dedicated volunteers, all marching through the loop, make the McDonald's Thanksgiving Parade an annual celebration for the whole family. The 2013 McDonald's Thanksgiving Parade takes place live on State Street between Congress Parkway and Randolph Street in downtown Chicago on Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 28th from 8 to 11. On the line with right now is the executive director of the Chicago Festival Association presenting the 80th annual McDonald's Thanksgiving Day Parade, our good pal, Phil Purovich. Phil, I'm going to give a phone number if people would like to get some information. It's 312-239-0457. And certainly always a pleasure to have you on the show, and it's become a tradition to chat about this, and I'm sure it's going to be a great Thanksgiving Day.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to speak to you.
And safe travels back to Chicago, my pal.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Phil. Take care. Philip Purovich, the executive director of the Chicago Festival Association, now presenting the 80th annual McDonald's Thanksgiving Day Parade, Thursday, November 28th from 8 to 11. And again, for information, 312-239-0457. Always a pleasure chatting with Phil. And we do that every year in anticipation of the great parade. Hopefully the weather will be nice so everybody can enjoy themselves and have a wonderful Thanksgiving Day, or at least a way to start out the day. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, Gerald Charles Dickens, as he presents his hit one-man show, which is said to have become a once-in-a-lifetime brush with literary history. An Afternoon with Mr. Dickens on Sunday, November 17th at 1 at the historic Stan Mansion, 2408 North Kedzie, presented by Connie and Victor Allister of British Taste Events. The great-great-grandson of the immortal Charles Dickens. A delight to chat with Gerald. And I hope he's comes back to Chicago and visits us again. Sean Mullins, who will be performing at the Metropolis Performing Arts Center Saturday evening, November 23rd at 8, 111 West Campbell in downtown Arlington Heights. For information, 847-577-2121. Of course, his great hits, Lullaby and Light You Up. Finally, our good friend Phil Purovich, the executive director of the Chicago Festival Association, now presenting the 80th annual McDonald's Thanksgiving Day Parade, Thursday, November 28th from 8 to 11. For information, 312-239-0457. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought, every day at least, to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week, and as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Have a great day. In your eyes I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, any luck then I suppose. The music, the music.